Hello, everyone, and welcome back to day two of the Sustainable Agronomy Conference. On behalf of the American Society of Agronomy, we're glad you're here. I'm Jamie Nix, and I'll be your host, along with our moderator, Harry Green. So last week, we discussed precision ag and digital agronomy, and this week, we'll explore regenerative ag and agroforestry practices, along how you can monitor the success of the adoption of some of these practices through soil testing and other methods. You'll hear directly from experts that are working in the field. So we're proud to offer this event for free to all of our attendees, thanks to our sponsors, Syngenta and the Sulfur Institute. So we appreciate their support. This conference does take place every Wednesday for the month of July. We have one next week on the 23rd, and then our last one will be on July 30th. If you are interested in any more educational programming like this one, we've got two certification programs, the Certified Crop Advisors and the Certified Professional Soil Scientists. So you can scan these QR codes. I'll drop these links in the chat as well. Just a few housekeepings before we get started. If you're a regular attendee, you know most of these, but I'll just run through them really quick. We have a Q&A section at the end of both of these sessions. So feel free to add those in the Q&A portion, and then we'll get to those afterwards. If you have any technical difficulties, you can call our support center, which I'll also put in the chat. Otherwise, you can try refreshing the program. Leaving and rejoining usually does the trick. Today's webinar is worth two continuing education units, so for both of the hours, one for each. And so you'll have to get those credits at the end that will be automatically applied to your account. But make sure you hang on till the very end. That way our team can add it to your account. You'll get eight total for this whole conference. The last thing is we have a discussion board in our member hub, so you can join that through the link that I'll also put in the chat. You can add any reflections, any follow-up questions in there. You can also, you know, use your account and connect with other attendees for some networking. So now I will pass things off to Harry Green, Chief Science Officer at Propagate Ag. Thank you guys for being here.
Thank you, Jamie, and thank you, everyone, for joining. My name is Harry Green. I'm out of Trumansburg, New York. That's in the Finger Lakes. I have an agroforestry farm here. Also one of the co-founders of Propagate, where we plant trees on farms, and we have software, agronomy software, that lets you draw lines on a map, design your agroforestry farm, and then get 30-year financial statements and projections, and it lets you de-risk planting trees on farms, which we also do. So we're a lot like a solar contractor developer or a fencing contractor or developer, but we do that with trees, and we manage about 2,400 acres of agroforestry between Kentucky, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, and New York. And today we have two phenomenal panelists. We have Dr. Rob Myers and Kelsey Stubblefield. If you two could please introduce yourselves.
Thanks, Harry. I'm Rob Myers, and I'm at the University of Missouri, where I'm a faculty member in plant sciences and direct the Center for Regenerative Agriculture. I also work part-time with the USDA Sustainable Ag Research and Education Program. And happy to be here with you, and I'll hand it over to Kelsey to introduce herself.
Thanks, Rob. So yes, I'm Kelsey Stubblefield, an educational and training program specialist here at the University of Missouri Center for Agroforestry. Primarily, I coordinate our Agroforestry Training Academy and our Agroforestry Professional Certification Program and Learning Network. I'm also stepping in to assist more with our graduate program as well. As with most folks at the university, I get roped into doing some research here and there as well, primarily social science pertaining to agroforestry adoption. And I'm excited to share with all of you an overview of agroforestry today, and thanks for having me.
Wonderful. And with that, we are going to segue into Rob's presentation. Thank you all for joining.
Thanks again, Harry. Well, we're looking forward to the session today, and it was my task to start off with this whole area of regenerative agriculture, which, of course, has been in the news a lot. You see a lot of Farm Magazine and other stories about this. So let's dive right in and go to the next slide. So we are seeing regenerative ag a lot in the media. Interestingly, it's showing up even outside the agriculture media. Here's an article from Forbes magazine headlined Regenerative Ag, Soils, Cows, and Climate. We're seeing it pop up all over the place, both because of farmer interest and interest of major food and ag companies. Next slide. Those food and ag companies span the whole breadth of agriculture. So it's food and beverage companies, companies like Kellogg's, of course, that has a wide portfolio of brands, PepsiCo, which also, besides beverages, has a lot of snack foods and other food investments. PepsiCo, notably, a couple of years ago announced they were investing over $200 million to incentivize regenerative ag in the Midwest. Next. It's also grain trading companies such as Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland. Both of them have announced initiatives and are putting dollars behind incentivizing farmers to do regenerative ag. Cargill, for example, setting a goal of getting 10 million additional acres of regenerative ag through their efforts. Next. And it's even clothing companies. This one's one that I found particularly interesting. It's ones that are engaged directly in buying cotton from farmers for clothing like Wrangler. But even the fashion magazines have had a number of articles on regenerative ag, and so that's been kind of interesting to track. Next slide. So for all these reasons, a number of universities, nonprofit organizations, and others have started investing more in regenerative ag. Here at the University of Missouri, we launched a regenerative ag center about 4.5 years ago, and we've grown quickly. We have a staff of about 20 now working on 14 different projects encompassing about $45 million in effort. Our work is both regional and national. And I'm not going to go a lot into what we do at the center, but rather talk more about just the scope of what's happening with regenerative ag as a whole. So let's proceed with the next slide. So one of the common questions I often get, and maybe on your mind, is what in the heck is regenerative agriculture? There is no government definition of regenerative ag. There are a couple groups that have come out with their own definitions, but for our Center of Regenerative Ag at University of Missouri, we talk primarily in terms of outcomes and practices. We don't have our own one-sentence definition, but rather we say there are several outcomes we're pursuing. The first one, and the one we really focus the most on, is increasing soil health. But then there are a number of others around organic matter, better water quality, resilience to challenging weather, increased biodiversity, integration of crops and livestock. And I'll come back to some of these as we go through the slides. And then, of course, ultimately, we want to support the health and vitality of farming and ranching communities. Now, for practices, you know, there's a long list of things you could say are related to regenerative ag. This is just a partial list I have here. It is ones we particularly focus on at our center. So the biggest thing we happen to work on is cover crops, but we also work on diversifying crop rotations, advancing no-till and strip-till, supporting agroforestry. And you're going to hear from my wonderful colleague Kelsey here in a moment about our Center for Agroforestry, which does some great work in that area, and we collaborate closely with them. We've moved heavily also into managed intensive grazing. I'm going to talk a little bit about some new technologies like virtual fencing that I'm excited about. We try to support farmers in their efforts to improve their nutrient and pest management, also where appropriate to integrate pollinators and other habitat improvements, including conservation buffers. So I'll touch on some of these practices and hit how they fit into achieving outcomes that I've identified here. Next. So starting with cover crops, as I said, that's the single biggest practice we work on at our center, although we definitely are engaged with a lot of other practices. It's probably the one you hear cited the most often by the food and ag companies. If you look at the programs they're incentivizing, whether it's food and beverage companies, other consumer product companies, a lot of them are paying specifically farmers to do cover crops because of the multiple benefits they provide. So I'd like to take just a few minutes to talk a bit about how cover crops fit into regenerative ag, and then we'll look at some other practices as well. Next slide. So I think you're all well aware cover crops are a key soil health practice. You can see here a diversity of cover crops being grown. That's something we work on a lot in our region, is trying to help farmers figure out which cover crop species or mixes are appropriate for them. Next. Ultimately, we're trying to feed the soil biology with living roots. So NRCS, a number of years ago, identified various soil health principles, one of the key ones being to have living roots as much of the year as possible. We've learned that the soil biology really benefits by having living roots, because those roots are exuding carbohydrates or sugars that many of the microbes, particularly fungi and certain bacteria, are taking advantage of. And then, of course, those fungi and bacteria are forming the basis of that food chain in the soil ecosystem. Next. Many of you have seen a diagram like this. I think it's interesting when I go back to my own training in agronomy, you know, that we were focused much more on soil chemistry and physics, but we've recently been learning a lot more about soil biology over the last decade or two. And we have so much more to learn, obviously, as we continue to explore this area. But certainly there's this whole food chain that starts with the bacteria and fungi and all the things that are feeding on them, ranging from protozoa to nematodes. Sometimes we think of nematodes as a negative thing in the soil, but there are a lot of beneficial nematodes as well. Those in turn are being fed on by arthropods, which ultimately are going to be fed on by certain animals and birds. Next. Now, cover crops do provide a lot of benefits for resiliency. I think you're all aware of this. This particular photo is an interesting one. It's from a farm in Oklahoma in the very wet spring of 2019. Now, many of you will remember that in 2019, we had such widespread wet weather that almost 20 million acres were not planted in the Corn Belt that year. And you compare that to a more typical year, it would be maybe 2 to 4 million acres not being planted. So almost 10 times as much as we might see in a more average year not being able to be planted at all. And these are acres that farmers ended up collecting prevent plant crop insurance on. So in this particular photo, on the left side of the road is a field that's been long-term cover crops and no-till. Across the road, same soil type as a conventionally managed field, no cover crops and regular tillage. And although it's just one situation, this is one of those cases where a photo is worth a thousand words, because you can see a lot of water standing over there in that conventionally managed field. It doesn't have the same level of water infiltration, water holding capacity that that long-term cover crop no-till field has, and it thus we're not able to get in there and plant as early. I participated in a study with the University of Illinois where we looked at thousands of fields for that year of 2019 with USDA data, and indeed there was less applications for prevent plant crop insurance on fields that had cover crops and no-till, and also farmers were able to plant earlier that year where they had cover crops and no-till than in conventionally managed fields. So good example of resilience in wet weather. Next. Now, we also wonder about dry conditions. Of course, in a lot of areas, we're seeing more prolonged droughts, more intense droughts. And I think when we look at cover crops, especially when combined with no-till, there's a lot of things that happen. We could look at several different factors. I want to focus here particularly on that rainfall infiltration that happens with macropores. When we have cover crops, a couple things happen related to macropores. One is stimulation of earthworm activity. Also, we have more root channels from those cover crops, and both of those things contribute to soil layers that can also prevent soil from draining more fully through the profile. Next slide. Mycorrhizal fungi are interesting. We've been hearing a lot about those in the agriculture news. I still think we have more to learn here, but no question, these fungi are playing a big role in helping many plants access more nutrients and sometimes even water by effectively expanding the volume of soil that those roots are tapping into for nutrients. So again, these mycorrhizal fungi are associating with the plant roots, getting carbohydrates from the plant roots, such as the corn, and then in return providing certain nutrients back to the corn. So a very interesting relationship that happens. Those fungi are stimulated when we have cover crops providing living roots year-round. Where we have tillage and no cover crops, the amount of mycorrhizal fungi has been documented to substantially diminish in the soil. So these are one of the many benefits the cover crops are providing. Next. Now let's talk a little bit more about integrating other praxis. So when we integrate livestock into the system, one way we can do that is by grazing cover crops. We've seen some real benefits to soil health by doing this. As we're adding that manure, urine, and saliva from the grazing animal, it seems to stimulate the soil biology. And if we go to the next slide, we can reflect on the fact that our soil microbial systems evolved with herbivores as part of the system, whether it was prairies with grazing animals such as buffalo or even woodland situations. They all had herbivores to some degree, And so that microbial community, when we put it in a row crop field with no animals involved, it's not getting the environment that those microbes evolved to subsist in. So I think there is a real advantage, where feasible, to bring the animals back into the system. Next slide. One of the ways we can do that is with a new technology called virtual fencing. I just earlier this week took some virtual fencing collars out to a farmer here in Missouri. We're starting a new $1 million project to help farmers try virtual fencing in the state of Missouri. And we are now seeing several new companies that have entered the U.S. market in the last year starting to offer these, coming from Norway, New Zealand, Australia, where they've been being used for a few years now. A big focus of these is with cattle, both dairy and beef cattle. In this case, you're seeing the company No Fences product, but there are similar products from other companies like Halter, E-Shepherd system from Gallagher, Vence is another company in the U.S. All of these devices emit an auditory tone as the animal is approaching a prescribed boundary. So you kind of see that depicted in the right. And that boundary is defined on a phone, tablet, or computer. So instead of going out there and having to move electric fencing regularly to set up a rotational grazing plan, this virtual fencing can allow that paddock rotation to be set up right on a phone, which is obviously a big labor-saving device. But there's other benefits as well. For example, with cover crop grazing, obviously we often don't have fences around the field, so it prevents or allows that possibility to come in and graze the cover crops. And I will quickly add that if we're near a roadway, we strongly encourage the use of a physical fence to protect both the animals and drivers. In the event that the animals would go past that virtual fencing barrier, if you're well back away from a road, that may not be necessary, but in many cases, a perimeter fence is going to be in order. Still, though, if we can get a temporary perimeter fence around that row crop field, such as a two-strand electric wire, then we can do rotational grazing within that, say, 40-acre, 80-acre field without having to put a lot of internal electric fencing. So these collars are going to provide a shock if the animal goes past the auditory defined boundary, but the animals quickly learn where that boundary is and only rarely, if ever, get shocked after that initial learning period, which can be as little as a few days, at the high end, maybe a week to get trained. The other benefits include knowing those animals' health based on their movement. If they should happen to go past the prescribed boundary, a notification sent to the manager, and they can be re-enclosed by redrawing the boundary, or typically they'll rejoin the herd because there's no penalty to walking back to where the rest of the herd is. They don't get shocked by rejoining the herd, only if they're leaving the prescribed area. So it makes possible multiple moves a day, makes possible more irregularly shaped paddocks, easier to fence out, for example, streams or other sensitive areas, and again, lots of labor savings. Interestingly, NRCS in many states is going to be starting to offer incentive payments for farmers to adopt this practice because of some of the regenerative ag benefits. Next slide. We're also seeing interest in a lot of areas in getting more biologically diverse pastures. In my state of Missouri, you know, the predominant pasture forage is tall fescue. It's very productive in spring and fall, but the pastures aren't very diverse. They're not very productive in the heat of summer, especially in dry weather. So we're seeing an effort in a lot of areas to have some pastures that are more biologically diverse, including some warm season native pastures. And in our state, we've seen big incentives from both our federal NRCS program and our state government to support that. Next. And then there's the option of integrating grazing with forestry. I know Kelsey will be talking to you about some agroforestry programs, so I don't want to steal her thunder, but just briefly touch on this. The photo on the left is a farmer named Josh Payne that both Kelsey Center and mine work with. He has about 800 sheep in a agroforestry grazing system, and you can see some tree tubes. They had just planted chestnuts. You'll hear more about some of the tree planting later. And he's got an electric wire running across from tree tube to tree tube, and then a wire wrapped around those tree tubes to keep the sheep from pushing up against and rubbing against those tree tubes. Kind of an innovative system he's done. But he's using that grazing in between the chestnuts to provide income, obviously, while the chestnuts are maturing. On the right, we can see a silvopasture system, something we've been promoting jointly with the Center for Agroforestry here in Missouri. where we can provide shade to the animal, but also improve soil organic matter and improve biological diversity in that area. Next. And then conservation buffers are something, of course, that have been talked about for years in many areas where we have relatively little diversity. Like I grew up on a farm in central Illinois, and we initially had windbreaks. Those are now gone. Those conservation buffers can be helpful in reducing both soil loss and loss of nutrients and pesticides from fields. Next slide. Interestingly, there's other approaches, and not just putting the buffers around the end of the field, but making them biodiverse plantings in strips across the slope of a field. So Iowa State University particularly has been effective in promoting the idea of what they call prairie strips. And these are diverse plantings where maybe 10% of the field is planted to the prairie strip on a contour. They've shown dramatic benefits in reduced soil erosion, loss of nutrients, and loss of pesticides from a field. What I find interesting is with virtual fencing and cover crops, if you can plant cover crops in between these prairie strips and then use virtual fencing or even standard electric fencing to come in and graze the field, then you can get economic value from that prairie strip as well as the rest of the field. So I think we're seeing some interesting opportunities to integrate these regenerative practices. Next. So just to summarize, and then we'll hand it over to Kelsey, definitely regenerative ag continues to be a hot topic. We see over a dozen major companies offering incentives to farmers in one way or another to do regenerative practices. Some of those companies are offering those incentives across multiple states. As I've alluded to here in the last part of my presentation, I think there's real opportunities to stack together some of these conservation practices and get even bigger benefits by doing that on our fields and farms. We're very interested in looking for ways to build soil health, as I know most of you are, and finding ways to add diversity to the plants we're growing on a farm through all the different methods I talked about, cover crops, buffer strips, agroforestry where appropriate, diverse pastures. And again, we're seeing more funds available to help these farmers do this, whether it's through NRCS programs, state-level programs, or the private sector. Finally, I'll mention that many of you are aware there are some great resources. We particularly at our center have been working a lot on video tools to help farmers as they're maybe driving their auto steer tractor, be able to watch a video, short video about how to do some of these things. And I know some of you are engaged with that as well. So just encourage you to check that out either through our Center for Regenerative Ag or other resources. So with that, I will hand it over to Kelsey.
Okay, hopefully everybody can see that screen now.
Yes, looks good.
Okay, great. So good morning, everyone. Thanks again for having me today. As I said before, I'm Kelsey Sibblefield, an educational program specialist here at the Center for Agroforestry at the University of Missouri. And before we jump in, I just want to share a little bit about the Center for Agroforestry and what we do. The Center for Agroforestry is a preeminent global center within the University of Missouri School of Natural Resources that was founded in 1998. And we have three primary emphasis areas that guide our work. Research is a key one. As I'll mention later, agroforestry practices are not new systems, but by modern Western science standards, there's still a lot that hasn't been explored in the world of agroforestry. So our researchers are committed to documenting and putting numbers to the environmental and economic and numerous social and societal benefits of agroforestry, as well as improving the viability of perennial specialty crops, which are often a prominent feature of agroforestry systems. Education is the other big arm of what we do. We do offer graduate degrees, so a lot of our programming does center around educating and equipping graduate students. However, we also recognize the echoing impact of train-the-trainer type programming. So we have some robust offerings in that realm as well to get that valuable knowledge into the hands of folks who are high touch with producers. And lastly, a lot of participants in our programs are producers themselves who then go on to establish agroforestry and be a voice for these practices in their communities. We lovingly call them our agroforestry champions. And we do engage in some public outreach, partnership building, and sharing our findings with policymakers as well. If you're interested in learning more about our center, I have our website posted a few times throughout this presentation. It's centerforagroforestry.org. All right, so let's jump in with the big question. What is agroforestry? Okay, well, that's easy. It's an intentional intensive land use management strategy combining woody perennial species such as trees or shrubs with crops and or livestock. And actually, that sounds kind of stuffy. So what you need to know is that it's trees on farms on purpose. And the on purpose is really key there. A random black walnut tree on your property that your grandfather planted, that you occasionally collect nuts from, that's a great thing, but it doesn't constitute an agroforestry practice. For a practice to be considered agroforestry, we typically look for it to meet certain criteria. The four I's from the USDA are a great way to consider whether something could be classified as agroforestry or not. So those four I's are, is it intentional? Is it intensive? Is it integrated? And have interactions been considered and planned for? Those are the key factors. And I'm sure some or many of you have seen this diagram from Foley et al., highlighting what natural ecosystems achieve versus intensive cropland. And then finally, a more intentionally designed agroecosystem where the goal is to achieve that core spoke of crop production while also achieving a balance among all of these other spokes. And agroforestry aims to fit there. And importantly, agroforestry is really just a new term for an ancient set of practices. When you think about humanity and our cultivation of food, growing food alongside and among and within trees is really one of the oldest forms of agriculture. And indigenous peoples hold a lot of knowledge, but also culture and history in these types of practices. So though Western study of agroforestry is relatively new, they are certainly not new practices, and we try to honor that as much as we can. So you might be thinking, cool. Well, what does agroforestry actually look like in practice? Well, there are lots of ways that this combination of woody perennials on farmland can happen. And as always, when you try to bucket or categorize things, there's going to be some gray area, some crossover and whatnot, and some things that defy categorization. But generally, there are five recognized temperate agroforestry practices. Riparian forest buffers, where strips of trees and shrubs and grasses are planted between agricultural lands and water bodies. Windbreaks, where trees are established to block harmful winds from crops or farm buildings or livestock. And then silvopasture, where livestock, forages, and trees are intentionally combined to provide short-term and long-term income sources. As Rob said, there are some really cool examples of silvopasture happening right now. Josh Payne in Missouri, Greg Judy in Missouri, if any of you are on YouTube and have seen Greg Judy, regenerative rancher, he's doing silvopasture here in Missouri as well. George Owens in the Panhandle of Florida has been doing pine silvopasture for, I think, over 30 years now. And all of these farmers have seen some really amazing benefits for their animals and for their land and their financing. Alley cropping, so where crops are cultivated between rows of trees. Forest farming, where high-value products like forest botanicals or mushrooms are cultivated in the understory of existing forest stands. And then finally, there's also urban forest gardens, also called urban food forests, if that's a term you're more familiar with, which is an emergent sixth practice, which establishes a very high diversity of tree and shrub crops, mimicking an early successional forest to provide food and education and engagement opportunities, typically within an urban community. But what's the point? Monocultures are straightforward. why go to the effort of establishing an agroforestry practice? Well, there are numerous benefits. So we've got diversified products and economic resilience. We've got improved quality and marketability. So especially with things like windbreaks that might be shielding some more sensitive annual crops from wind damage. We've got aesthetics and natural beauty, carbon sequestration, recreational opportunities, wildlife habitat, improved soil and water quality. We've got erosion control, and we're kind of running out of room here, but we've got reduced inputs and fossil fuel usage, reduced heat stress on livestock leading to improved weights and milk production, we've got mitigated nutrient and pesticide runoff, and many more. But I'll give you one of our favorite answers in the agroforestry world. It depends. It all depends on how you design it. So what agroforestry system land managers choose to adopt, what species they choose to cultivate within that system, it fully depends on their existing natural, physical, and financial resources. But more importantly than that even, it depends on what their goals and objectives are. What do they want to accomplish in that space? Are they wanting that farm financial diversity and resilience in the form of, say, a high-value tree crop like a chestnut or a pecan or a fruit, with an additional annual crop grown in the alleyways to provide that more immediate income? Are they wanting to just attract wildlife to their land and enhance the natural beauty of their space? Are they specifically wanting to protect their buildings or annual crops or livestock from damaging winds or snow? Are they wanting to make their farm more resilient to other forms of extreme weather? You can design agroforestry systems to accomplish all of those goals and more. And I've included here some of what we consider to be the core guiding questions for designing an agroforestry planting. And if you're interested in learning more about what this process looks like, our agroforestry planning and design handbook is available for free on our website. I see Jamie went ahead and populated the link for us. Thank you. But let's look at some examples of what this might look like. I like a case study. I need examples. So let's get ready for those. So say a resource inventory is showing someone with prime area for a riparian buffer. They aren't wanting to dedicate a lot of time and energy to the maintenance of it. Their goals and priorities may be centering around hunting, preserving and protecting the waterway, maybe some passive income if they can get it. Well, we might be looking at putting something like this together. So this is a riparian forest buffer with native trees and shrubs and forbs to support filtration. So it's trying to select species in those zones 1 through 3 that are supporting habitat and food for quail and ducks and the like. And then maybe also looking in zones 2 and 3. So 1 being the zone closest to the water body and then 2 and 3 further away. Zones 2 and 3 looking for species that maybe aren't a ton of upkeep, but could maybe also generate some income, like curly willows, which we could sell as woody florals. Or maybe maple trees that could serve double duty. They could be tapped when they reach maturity, in addition to the samaras from the maples being a food source for waterfowl. So another example might be a landowner with a lot of unused forest land on their property, which is extremely common, especially around here in Missouri, and looking for ways to sort of utilize that land that's sitting and generate some additional revenue in the coming years. So clearing out the brush from that understory and setting up, say, wine cap mushroom beds can give a sellable product in about a year's time or less. Or let's say if you're thinning the area some, you're thinning some other parts of your farm, cutting down some trees, inoculating some shiitake spawn in those logs can give you mushrooms in about 2 years, and those logs will keep producing for up to 7. And one of the cool things about shiitake logs is you can actually force fruit them. So if you know there's a specific pocket of time where you have a little bit more capacity, you can submerge them for a certain period of time, let them come up, and then they'll fruit sort of on your time frame to a certain extent. So that can be helpful. And then we could be looking at growing some forest botanicals like ginseng or bloodroot, which could be sold in about 5 to 8 years at a pretty high price point. So let's also say now, for our third example, we've got a farmer who has done the corn and soybean rotation for many years now. They have some well-drained soils, but are looking to step away from all of that acreage to focus on something smaller, something that'll still provide a high return through their retirement, but on a smaller acreage, and something that'll keep producing for years to come for their kids and grandkids. So let's look at alley cropping. Chinese chestnut is a very hot ticket right now, and a lot of chestnut growers can't keep up with the sheer demand that they're seeing in the market. Of course, you know, we're looking at it'll take around 5 to 7 years to see a crop, but while those trees are maturing, there's ample sun in those alleys. So you've got multiple years there to grow something that needs sun. These particular farmers did pumpkins and then transition to something more shade tolerant and better suited when the trees mature. So these farmers chose winter wheat for their alleys because in its life cycle, the winter wheat uses water in the early spring when the chestnuts don't need it, keeping excess water off of the roots, which is great because chestnuts don't like wet feet. And then when the chestnuts need water, the wheat has been harvested. And those remaining stalks from when the wheat are cut, cut and dropped, which creates a mat on the floor beneath the chestnut trees. So when the chestnuts fall in the autumn, it simplifies, they fall on this mat and it simplifies harvest and can even mitigate some issues like chestnut weevil. So then the producers are able to collect the nuts using hand harvester nut wizards and sell them online. And I'll tell you, from having talked to this particular farmer multiple times, he is never worried about not selling his product. He's never worried about having an excess of product and not being able to move it. His biggest issue was a year when he took advanced orders and barely squeaked out the yield to meet the orders. So he doesn't do advanced orders anymore. He lists the pounds on his website when he has them. And he once had a couple hundred pounds left over. He listed them at 10 p.m. By 8 a.m. the next morning, they were gone. So some of these high-value tree crops can present real opportunities for folks. So I'm sure by now you're sold. But I also don't blame you if you're wondering, if agroforestry is so great, why isn't everyone doing it? When I drive down the road, I see mosaics of corn and soy, not trees. And that's a fair point. There are some roadblocks to agroforestry. A not insubstantial one is the establishment costs and delayed returns. Trees are expensive. The dollars and cents of it all, establishing trees or even just the process of clearing and preparing a site and then having to wait for a return, that can be hard for folks to swallow. And for some, it doesn't seem feasible. And that's why leaning into shorter returns via annuals and livestock and non-timber forest products can be beneficial and can lessen some of that burden for many folks. And some folks, when it comes to timber species, do explicitly say that that perennial part of their system, those are gifts for their kids and grandkids. Not always, but a lot of times. Another big barrier is training and knowledge needs. Even if folks have been farming their whole life, if that's been annuals, trees can feel like a completely alien or entirely new thing. And also, and importantly, it's not just the growers who feel like they're lacking the know-how, but sometimes technical service providers are unfamiliar with agroforestry as well. So when a producer comes into their office and they're interested in it, they feel ill-equipped to answer because it's just out of their wheelhouse. And on the research side of it, tree crops and the like have been receiving a good bit of research dollars and emphasis these last few years. But there are so many species that can be incorporated into agroforestry systems. Factoring that in and comparing, you know, the money that more traditional commodities have gotten, you know, those research dollars are nothing compared to it, and there's a lot left to learn. And then I'll say, as agroforestry has grown in recent years, another barrier folks are running into is limited germplasm for certain cultivars. So just trying to get the cultivars of these specialty crops that they want to plant is becoming a barrier. So a farmer in our network here in Missouri submitted an EQIP grant detailing the specific cultivars of pawpaws that she was going to establish with that money. Great. She got the grant. She's ready to order them from the nursery. She places her order. Those varieties are not available. Okay, well, do you have these pawpaw varieties? No, we're out of pawpaws altogether. Called another nursery, same thing. Another nursery, same thing. And there are not a ton of nurseries who carry these varieties. And the next year she pivoted to, please just send me any pawpaws that you have. And that's certainly not an isolated incident. It's something that we're thinking about a lot more as agroforestry is continuing to grow. And there are a lot more barriers that we don't have the time to get into today, like infrastructure and processing bottlenecks, social stigmas, the limited but growing government support, complicated crop insurance, land tenure issues, and more. But there are active efforts by many organizations to reduce these barriers to entry, and there's been a really encouraging level of interest and excitement surrounding agroforestry these last few years. Just to touch on a couple things that our center is doing to lessen that knowledge gap, we have an agroforestry training academy that is offered every year, which is a 5-week online agroforestry crash course, followed by a 3-day in-person field component here in mid-Missouri, where we have some hands-on activities and we see 7 active farms doing agroforestry. This is open to producers and professionals alike. This program has been going for 12 years and has graduated over 350 alumni. I actually think that might be an old number. As of 2025, I think we're over 400 alumni. Our program has been maxed out these past 2 years with a full cohort and a wait list. I hate turning people away from the program, but it is really encouraging to see that level of interest in agroforestry programming. We also have a pilot certification program that we're creating and launching in Missouri this year. This program was built on that idea that there's always more to learn in agroforestry. So how do we continue learning? How do we recognize the folks who are knowledgeable and ensure that they're connected to each other and the growers who are interested in giving agroforestry a shot? And I spoke a little of our graduate programs. That is a big arm of what we do. And we've graduated many alumni, including myself and Jamie Nix, the organizer of this wonderful conference that you're at. And those alumni are out in various sectors contributing to the growth of agroforestry. And also our faculty, research staff, and students are the lifeblood of those very valuable research projects and publications that tell us more about agroforestry and perennial specialty crops every day. So in addition to research articles, we do have many outreach and training publications, which are available for free on our website. So we have some comprehensive technical guides on a variety of topics. You can see here some of those specialty crops I mentioned, pawpaw, pecans, elderberries, black walnut, Chinese chestnut. Those feature prominently. They feature in a lot of agroforestry systems that you'll see. We also have a very robust training manual that dives into each of the 6 practices that I talked about and provides some more like rich applied information for those and case studies. That manual and the planning and design handbook I mentioned earlier are on our website for everyone to access. I also wish I could mention every organization that is doing incredible agroforestry-centric work right now, but there isn't time. So I'll just say that if you do not know, USDA does have a dedicated National Agroforestry Center. Their website has hundreds of agroforestry educational materials in every format you can think of. And they're currently building out a regional examples page that showcases agroforestry across the US from Hawaii to Maine and everywhere in between. So do give them a look if you're hoping to learn more. And lastly, I'll leave you with this. I know I listed some barriers, but we're seeing agroforestry increase every day. In the span of 2017 to 2022, it grew 6%, or nearly 2,000 more farms started doing it in the U.S. And beyond that, you know, anecdotally, a lot of folks who work in agroforestry will tell you that that growth and interest seems to be compounding every year. And a few years ago, you know, we were the ones telling people what agroforestry was at every event we were at. Now, a lot of folks are coming up to us already knowing what it is and just yearning to learn more about it. And so in 2022, our Agroforestry Academy that I mentioned had 25 or 30 people. We were begging people to register for that program. And then just from 2022, in 2023, we filled up all 50 of our spots very quickly. And then in 2024 and 2025, we actually had to pivot to an application model. And we've been seeing around 100 applications every year for that program. So that has been really encouraging. I keep saying it's a great problem to have, and it doesn't seem to be slowing down. So that's what I have for you today. There's our website as well as my contact information. Do reach out. I'm happy to answer anything that you might want to know. Thank you.
Big thanks to Rob and Kelsey for knocking these presentations out of the park. I think we all learned something new, maybe 10 things. First topic, first question, I'm thinking about the intersection between your presentations, both of them, and with fencing in a silvopasture. You don't want trees falling on your fences, whether that would ground them out or just decrease their efficacy, letting your animals out, letting other animals in. Have either of you seen virtual fencing in a silvopasture? If so, or if not, how does that spark joy? And could you tell us a little bit about how that could work?
Well, Kelsey and I both mentioned a farm named Josh Payne. He's going to be in the next week installing virtual fencing collars on his sheep in a silvopasture system. So that'll be the first one I personally know of. There may be others that have done it recently. Again, this technology is pretty new to the U.S. I do think it can be helpful in a silvopasture system for a variety of reasons. Now, what it's not going to be so good at is fencing out an individual tree. It's not really designed to do that. You could have an exclusion zone, is what the fencing virtual fencing companies call it, for a row of trees or a group of trees where the animals can't approach those. But it's not really going to work with the current technology to like keep the animal away from each individual tree by itself. So.
Yeah, exactly what Rob said. I think from the moment that virtual fencing sort of entered the conversation, you know, folks in the silvopasture realm were talking about, okay, how do we integrate this? It is still a fairly new technology. So a lot of what I've experienced have been, I said there's multiple organizations doing wonderful agroforestry work, and I can't talk about all of them, but another one I will plug is Savannah Institute. And so some folks there, like Julie Hager is one of the folks who does silvopasture, and she did sort of a lovely presentation on what virtual fencing would look like sort of integrated into silvopasture. I think a lot of it, you know, as with any new technology, there are sort of like kinks to be worked out and everything. And like Rob said, Josh Payne has really got it down how to protect those individual sort of trees. Still encouraging grazing like in and around the trees, but protecting the individual trees themselves. And, you know, virtual fencing, I think, just wasn't quite there. But I think increasingly it is. And we're starting to see folks at the beginning stages of incorporating that into agroforestry. Very iterative. I'm sure, you know, folks will make mistakes and we'll learn about it, but I do see it being a large part of the conversation moving forward.
And Harry, I know we had a question about the type of livestock. I'll just quickly say it is limited to cattle, sheep, and goats currently.
Yep. No horses, llamas, emus, nothing like that. All right. So one more question on silvopasture, tree species selection. Are these timber trees? Are they nut trees? Are they shrubs? What's the scoop?
Yes, they are. And so going back to that slide I had that was sort of detailing the questions that we're asking in the planning and design stage, what trees make sense to establish in a silvopasture is going to depend ultimately on the reason, well, you know, obviously like the climate and soils in your area, but then also what sort of you're envisioning as far as like management. Do you feel like you can sort of keep up with a tree crop, you know, or are you really just wanting the sort of benefits that are provided to your livestock through shade? You know, and so I mentioned, we talked about Josh Payne's, he's doing chestnut trees. So he is hoping to get a sellable crop off of those trees. But George Owens, who I mentioned in Florida, was doing pines, and his vision is to have those pines, you know, they'll be harvested after he's gone, but for those to sort of be like part of the inheritance for his sons and his grandchildren. And he didn't necessarily need that, that income off of, you know, a nut product, you know, a nut or a fruit. He was seeing enough tangible benefits in his livestock and then in the resilience of his land to weather. And we all know how Florida is. He was seeing enough of those benefits that it made financial sense for him to, you know, not need a nut crop. And so it's truly whatever is going to work best for your individual needs and objectives.
So it can be offset costs of, say, foregone weight gain due to heat. It can be the checking account, and it can be the savings account. It can be the 401k, all those things.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Awesome.
And we had some, we have some questions in the chat. I'll see if I can weave them all together, but still be inclusive to all of them on cover cropping. So there are some questions on pests, harboring pests in the cover crop. And there are some, there's a question about how do you incorporate animals without damaging a cash crop like cotton or corn. And then the, yeah. Pests on cover crops, and then integration with animals. How do you do that?
Yeah, I'll tackle that one. So with the grazing, starting with that, there are definitely a variety of approaches being used. The most common grazing with cover crops is either grazing a winter annual mix or just winter cereals following harvest of our cash crops, such as corn or soybeans or cotton, and then maybe again in the spring, depending on what cover crop's there. So based on farmer surveys, about half the farmers do both fall and spring grazing of cover crops. The other half will do just one or the other. Now, with summer cover crops, such as things that might be planted after winter wheat harvest or an early vegetable, it is possible to do a diverse mix that is grazed in the mid and late portion of the summer. And that is a particularly good way to help build soil health, both because of the plant diversity and because there's a more prolonged grazing period. But we see both those options, grazing winter cover crops and grazing summer ones. On the pest front, that's an interesting one. There are definitely questions about that. We don't really have too many pests to worry about with summer cover crops or fall planted cover crops in the fall. Where we do worry about it a little is in the spring when we're going to be planting a spring crop like a corn or soybean. I would say it's somewhat rare that there's a real issue, but where there is a concern is if that cover crop is left growing for a long period, what we call planting green, and it's still alive and green when the cash crop is planted. There's a potential for certain insect pests, such as cutworms, to be there in a greater percentage than they would be in a conventional field. What the research is showing is mixed right now. In some cases, we're seeing more beneficial insects in that green cover crop stand that are helping control pests. And in other isolated cases, we're seeing more pests there. So I would say it's just a question of scouting. I wouldn't be overly concerned about it, but it is something to monitor.
Phenomenal. And I guess we're just going to segue to another topic. We have some good ones in the chat here. When you add these new crops or new systems to a farm, you often go through organic certification or look at value add, value captured via grass fed, whether you're growing a crop that does not have a price floor, so you can't just sell it to the elevator or a local buyer. You often have to become a marketer as well. And you have to maybe bring what you're producing all the way direct to consumer or one step before, say you're part of a co-op. How do you both see farmers adopting newer regenerative practices and not just improving soil health, but translating that to the bottom line at the end of the day?
Kelsey, do you want to go first?
Sure. Yeah, I'll say, Harry, I think you are touching on something important there, which is, you know, for folks like in the third example that I presented, someone who had been selling corn and soy for his whole life, that is a farmer that we do know and work with here in Missouri. It was a pivot to then move into Chinese chestnuts and a completely different strategy than what he had been doing before. And, you know, you'll talk to some folks, producers and professionals in agroforestry realm who do say there is sort of a personality type, you know, like there is some, a lot of it is sort of relationship building, whether that be, you know, are you selling to grocery stores? Are you selling at farmers markets? Are you doing, you know, direct to consumer online? It can be sort of like a new world for folks to enter into. That's not to say you can design agroforestry systems with products that you don't necessarily, you know, have to, you know, that don't necessarily incorporate some of those specialty products with more like underdeveloped markets, or that you can't, you know, take something to a grain elevator or what have you. But yeah, that is something that is, you know, in a part of the conversation there. And the second part of your question was sort of about how translating that from sort of, you know, these systems, their environmental impacts, also translating that to the bottom line. So I mentioned, you know, George Owens in Florida. A big story he likes to tell is whenever, a hurricane came through. And so, you know, one of the barriers I mentioned before was social stigma. And one of the things that George Owens had been experiencing was a lot of skepticism from neighbors. And, you know, he started doing silo pasture 25, 30 years ago when it was not, you know, by any means something that people were talking about or doing. And he encountered a lot of skepticism. And it, he said it took several years, and it took a hurricane coming through. And when his trees were more mature, he said, you know, farmers don't understand a lot, but they understand topsoil washing away. And so when, you know, everyone was very much flooded, and Robbie showed that, you know, wonderful photo of, you know, cover crops on one side versus not on the other. And he sort of lived that among his neighbors and like the resilience of his land versus what other folks were experiencing. And that was a direct, you know, sort of an environmental incentive for him, but a very like a financial benefit as well. And he has seen some of those effects that I mentioned as far as just like reduced heat stress on his livestock, leading to those improved weights. And those are things that are very, you know, bring it to the bank. And I can understand that. And then with things like alley cropping, an economic diversification is increasingly an important part of the conversation. If something happened, you know, if there's a sort of commodity built into that, and, you know, there's a volatile market with one of your products, the idea that you have sort of a cushion with the other product in the system is increasingly relevant and very enticing for folks. And Rob, sorry, I talked for like 3 or 4 minutes, and we don't have much time left, but if you want to hop in.
Well, I'm conscious of our time and switching you over to the other speakers. I'll just quickly say it is possible to integrate organic and regenerative approaches. Organic already inherently has some regenerative approaches, such as more diversity. I think as we're adding cover crops in, that has often fit well with organic. We're seeing more interest by organic farmers in grazing cover crops, doing some integrated approaches. So definitely some farmers that are very innovative in this area, like a Dan DeSutter, Rick Clark in Indiana, are two good examples of row crop operators who are organic, doing very regenerative practices.
Good stuff. Kelsey, Rob, big thanks to you both. And we are on to the next session of this conference.